Welcome to the Agile Revolution. I'm Renee and we are sitting in a hotel in Sydney and I have two lovely people with me today. Firstly, our special guest, Christopher Avery. Welcome.
Thank you, Renee.
Welcome back, actually.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Welcome back to the podcast.
Yes.
First
time in Australia. And last time we talked was in Washington, I think.
Agile 2015, I believe.
Yeah. And an additional guest host today, I've got Peter Lightbody, who's a coach inside in the same organisation that I'm currently working on in Sydney. A behavioural expert, has had a lot of background inside of coaching, both life coaching and business coaching. Welcome, Peter, for the first time.
Thank you for having me.
Cool. So getting into it, Christopher, you have been in Australia for over a week.
Mm-hmm.
You've been at Scrum Australia. And you're talking in a meetup tonight. Tell, for the people who haven't had the lovely expectation of listening to you before, what are you all about?
What I'm all about is started 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, in team-based interventions and product development organizations. So I started studying organizational agility in 1985. Was totally unaware of the lightweight software development processes because I never dealt in the software lifecycle. I was always on the organizational development side of things. And I wrote a book in 2001 called Teamwork as an Individual Skill and ended up keynoting the first combined conference of XP and Agile Universe in 2004 in Calgary around that book. And you know, maybe a poor choice marketing-wise at the time, but I didn't talk about the book. It was the first time for me to focus a keynote on the responsibility process.
Mm.
And so my work for, well, since the 90s, has been helping people around the world start to discover and unpack this pattern in our minds by which all human beings process thoughts about taking and avoiding responsibility. And while we're all, quote, good responsible citizens and good people, the truth is we are really, really, really good at avoiding responsibility.
Yeah.
And so it becomes not a matter of morality or of good character. It's a matter of coping with stuff versus growing and overcoming it, which is central to Agile and to Scrum. The idea of personal ownership and shared ownership is foundational. And so that's been my contribution to the world of agility ever since. And since its crazy, weird, newish discoveries of just a few decades, and because it turns the idea of responsibility on its head, then it's pretty challenging work to grow it, to spread it, to get it around. And I'm happy to say that we have really strong following now in the Americas and in Europe, but relatively unknown in Australia. And there were some Australians, specifically Rowan Bunning, who came to the Global Scrum Gathering Munich, which I keynoted where we launched my book. And I also did a workshop there, and Rowan came back and pitched to the directors of Scrum Australia that they bring me here to start the process of getting the responsibility process better known here.
Great. And at Scrum Australia, you had a talk. What was it on?
It was on how agile leaders improve results with the responsibility process.
Mm-hmm.
So it was essentially a summary of an article that I wrote a few months back on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
By the same title.
And any key highlights you'd like to mention to our listeners?
Well, sure. So I think that article on LinkedIn, I think it offered nine specific connections between practicing responsibility and Agile. And I think the single most important one is simply self-leadership, self-organizing, self-management, and using it as a sense-making tool for leading yourself. So the responsibility process teaches me that leadership is innate, and it's in all of us, and it's not something some people have and other people don't. And if you tap into it, then it will help you discern your own compass heading, your own direction, what you want, what you don't want, how to get rid of what you don't want, how to overcome challenges and hurdles. So that'd be the first thing. The second would be as a shared organizing metaphor, right? Lots of organizations that perform highly have some kind of secret, maybe not so secret, but they have some core organizing metaphor that everybody in the organization understands and can apply it in any time or situation, and also use it in conversation with others around the question of, we've got this situation, what do you think we should do?
What's an example of one?
Well, I'll use this one, the responsibility process, mm-hmm. right? Let me give you an example of a different one rather than this one, then we can come back to this one. In W.L. Gore and Associates, which is one of those well-known companies with a very unique culture that nobody can copy, but is always talked about as being a very high-performing organization, their primary value, their primary core value, was what they called waterline principle. And the waterline principle stands for that line on a boat that's at the waterline, where if you were to make a mistake and punch a hole in the boat above the waterline, it's no big deal, no problem, no trouble, just clean it up.
Mm.
If you punch a hole in the boat below the waterline, then you've got a problem, and it also indicates that you've impacted other people. So you use this principle when you have a great deal of empowerment in that company. So if you're about to do something that could impact other people, and if it goes badly, it would be punching a hole below the waterline, then you're triggered to say, I better go talk to these other people. I better share the risk. We better get some consensus about what to do to move forward.
Okay.
So that's a kind of a central organizing metaphor that everybody can use to make sense of in organizations. And the responsibility process is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody understands it, how it works, it brings great humanity to us. It brings great compassion, forgiveness for mistakes, but it also gives us a language to talk to each other about our concerns or our fears, about making decisions, about taking risks, about confronting problems, about overcoming problems.
And we have certainly in a previous podcast gone into the responsibility process in a bit of detail. I'd love to do a bit more of a deep dive if we can today. But for people who may not have been fortunate enough to listen to that podcast, what's the 1 or 2 minute take on the responsibility process?
The 1 or 2 minute take on the responsibility process is that there's a pattern in your mind of mental states that every time something goes wrong, every time you have the least little bit of frustration or anxiety, it triggers this pattern called the responsibility process, and it starts you at the bottom coping. And the first state is called lay blame, in which our mind actually offers us the opportunity to blame somebody for the problem we're having. So how many times have you walked through your house, if you have a partner you live with, and said, honey, have you seen my briefcase, right? And there's a little insinuation of guilt in there. We're taught we shouldn't do that, but the truth is, it's the first place we go. It's as if it's the least computational effort for dealing with upset or frustration. And by the way, the people we normally blame are the ones on our favorites list on our phone, right? The people we're closest to. Eventually, you realize that it's a choice to stay there. So it starts out being unconscious or subconscious. What we teach is that you can be very aware of it, and then it's a choice. And if you realize that as long as you blame, you keep the problem, you're never going to get rid of it because you're a victim and the power is outside of you, then you actually choose to get off of it. Okay, I'm not going to blame. Well, your mind hands you another answer, which is an answer of a set of circumstances or situations outside of your control. So it's the weather, it's the economy, it's the culture around here. Essentially, there's nothing you can do about it because, again, you're the victim. And the perpetration is being done by a set of circumstances that you have no control over. If you sell out and buy that answer, you get to stay stuck, which means for the rest of your career, you may stand at the water cooler complaining with other people about whatever that is. So that's that anxiety never leaves. If you realize that doing that is a position of no power and decide to not do it, you graduate up to the next mental state, which we call shame, usually experienced as guilt. And all that happens here is that it's like this computer sorting routine in the mind has switched the variable from external cause to internal cause. So now, not only am I at a position of effect, I've got a problem, but I see myself as the cause of the problem, but not in a very positive learning way, but more in a victim of self way. So shame is lay blame on self. I'm a dummy. I'm a dolt. I'm so stupid. Will I never learn?
Mm.
Right? Keeping it on ourselves. And if you refuse to beat yourself up, you land in yet another state called obligation. And obligation is the mental state of feeling like we're trapped, feeling like we're burdened, feeling like we're totally screwed in a pattern or a promise or a commitment that we no longer like but can't do anything about. So I call it the mental state of have to, don't want to. And it's not until we refuse to feel trapped in life that part of our mind, I'm really technical here on psychology, part of our mind starts pinging the mental state of responsibility in our mind. And the mental state of responsibility is a place of feeling that we can do something to overcome any situation, any problem, any crisis, any upset in our life, and we can rid ourselves of it. So it's the mental state of freedom, choice, and power. And it's a place of creating exceptional results and feeling exceptional joy and happiness. And all of these mental states are available to us all the time. So my work is to help people take the responsibility process and turn it from being something unconscious in us to being very conscious, so that if we want to be more resourceful more of the time, we can catch ourselves in these mental states that are very natural. Nothing's wrong with us for having them. Right, and move ourselves up. So that's not a 2 or 3 minute version.
No, it's probably a 4 minute, but thank you.
You're welcome.
It's interesting you used the word we, and I know that you know that I've read the book since the last time that we talked and had some questions associated with it. The interesting thing that I've probably got probably near the tail end of the book is an understanding that this isn't necessarily a tool that a coach would directly use with someone to force them to understand responsibility, but there's more respect of inner consciousness associated with it. This is really a very great framework for self-reflection more than anything else. Would you see it being used as a tool for onto others, or is it in your mind just purely self-reflection?
Yeah. Great question. We're very clear that it only works when self-applied. So if you're using it as a coach, and I promote the use of the tool as a coach, is your job is not to label or use it as a weapon or assign a state of mind. Your job is to actually teach, share the responsibility process with your coachee, and ask them if they would like your help in helping them be more conscious, more aware of it. So it's the same work that I do everywhere with every audience.
Mm.
Is make it known, right? Get permission.
Yep.
And then very gently figure out how to get that person to self-apply it. So you may have a hypothesis that they're unjustified around some problem. Since it only works when self-applied, if you tell them you're unjustified, it doesn't land. Well, it might.
Mm, but less likely.
Less likely. It's more likely to land if you say, listening to your story and thinking about this chart. So we have these words on a poster, on a chart. I'm wondering if you see anywhere on this chart that you think you're representing in your mental state right now. It's amazing how many times we have the experience of seeing somebody, their eyes go like this, and then stop.
Yeah.
Stop. And I'll see what they're doing, I'll say, yeah, there.
And do you, in that situation, sometimes when you've self-assessed them to be somewhere else, and they believe they're maybe further up that chart or higher up towards responsibility, I take it you don't try and convince them otherwise.
I might say, look again.
Right.
Or I might say, tell me more about that. Yeah.
So,
would you ever introduce it to a group, a team, or is it just individuals?
Absolutely. introduce it to as many people as possible.
And how would you go about, say, working with a feature team and introducing the responsibility process to them and helping them think about it and self-apply it?
So every context is different. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to take into account for yourself, you know, your situation. Is it a more toxic environment? Is it a more positive or loving environment? Is the team more interested in, you know, the more people and interaction side of stuff? Is the team less interested? So, you know, I have no advice here on exactly how to do it.
Sure.
But the one piece of advice I would give, which I've used for years, is I would simply say, I know of a really powerful tool. It's been powerful to me. It's like all powerful tools. It's really simple and straightforward, but it kicks your butt when it comes to applying it. And I'd like to share it with you as a gift, and I can do it in 5 minutes and see if you're interested in me setting up an hour at another time.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever have any pushback on the word responsibility? Does it, for some people, it might feel like it's burdensome or the obligation side of things. Sometimes people have that own internal definition of the word responsibility.
Yeah, Peter, so this begs getting into definitions.
Mm.
And the word responsibility and the word accountability mean 1,000 different things.
Mm.
Right? And in the book, I make a very short list, right, of... When somebody says somebody should take responsibility and accountability for around here, what are they meaning? Well, they might mean somebody should be fired, somebody should learn, correct, and improve, somebody should be held to account. What's it mean?
Mm-hmm.
So at christopheravery.com/poster, you can download a poster of the responsibility process, and on the back is a summary of the points that I've just made, as well as definitions of each of the mental states. And the definition of responsibility is owning your power and ability to create, choose, and attract. And if you think that sentence starts short, you could add reality, or your experience, or everything at the end. So my world is 100% my reality, or my reality is 100% my responsibility, and that's because I've been making my own decisions in life for a few years. I've developed my own filters, or I've bought into the filters that were developed for me by well-intended parents and teachers and others. And that means if there's anything in my world I don't like that causes me a problem, it's mine to own. It's mine to do something about. The problem is not out there. Which is the toughest thing to learn and the most powerful thing to learn about practicing responsibility. But it maps to the history of responsibility, which in terms of etymology, most people agree it means the ability to respond, which means responsibility has nothing to do with history before this moment. It has to do with what you're going to do about it.
Mm.
So I got run over by a bus, spent a year in a hospital, lost my job, have no legs. Right? I can be bitter, right, which means totally focusing on the past.
Mm.
Or I can say, you know, there's a place in my mind where I can figure out how to overcome this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and be happy going forward. And I now am absolutely certain there is that place in our minds where we can do that. And number of paraplegics, people with all their skin burned off, you know, all the folks who call their disability just a little inconvenience, they've done that. They've found that place.
What I love about what you're talking about, that inner perception of reality, reminds me a lot of some work that Peter, you referred me to. So Byron Katie's The Work, where there's so much similarities between your book and hers, in that very internal focus, very perception reality focused, very much about looking at that and I guess almost like turning it on its head is really what it's about. So thank you, Peter, for sharing it with me, by the way, because I absolutely love her
work.
It's
good, isn't it?
In fact, she has a turnaround process.
Yeah,
she does.
She does. That's right.
So, I mean, are you familiar with her work, and where do you see those similarities?
Yeah, I'm only familiar with it, and I don't even know enough about it to be dangerous. But there's a number of my clients and students who've brought it up in our calls and even demonstrated it, and I absolutely see the relationship. Right? So I happen to believe that there's lots of models of that are getting really close to truth, and they just may look a little different from each other. Right, but you know that they're getting to the same thing, touching the same thing. And that's what I think about this work and Byron Katie's work. I also love that she calls it the work.
Yeah, yeah.
She's not the only one that calls their models the work.
Mm.
There's a brilliant, he's got, I don't know, I'm going to guess he's 80 or 90 years old. So a brilliant speech coach in Hollywood who has been the speech coach to the stars for decades named... Samuel Arthur, and he also calls what he does the work, and it starts with being completely conscious of each word you use before using it, and that's where his practice starts, and of course breath work and lots of other things. So I like the idea of the work. And for me, I no longer say that I'm a responsible person. I say that responsibility is what I practice. So I have a responsibility to practice. So for me, that's the work. So things go wrong all day long. And I get to either deny ownership of them or take ownership. And that's the work.
What did you see similarity-wise, Peter, between those two?
I think there's also a presupposition about what human beings are, what their fundamental nature is. Mm-hmm. So I think if I've understood your work correctly, the kind of supposition is that people can be at choice. They can be resourceful and they can respond in each moment. And I think in the work, the presupposition is that we're compassionate and also can choose, and that actually what gets in the way is just programming or stories or narrative that we have, and so the way through that is to continually look inside, be introspective, see what's kind of out of alignment and intuitively correct it more towards the truth, something like that.
I would say I'd completely agree with you, yes. That is an assumption here. And in fact, in the book, I talk about the cultural trance, which when we start looking into this, what we realize is that most societies teach us that we shouldn't blame and justify.
Mm-hmm.
And so we teach the same thing. However, I don't know anybody that has completely removed blame and justify thoughts from their mind, which means to me we're not bad learners.
Mm.
And this research suggests that it's hardwired.
Mm.
Where society labels us as bad, stupid, wrong, ignorant if we blame and justify, our model says there's nothing wrong with you. You're just a person with a problem and you're hurting, and this is the way you're coping with it because you don't know how to move up.
Yeah.
You don't know how to own it. So then we get up to the words in green. So blame and justify on our chart are in red. Shame and obligation. Society teaches us that these things are taking responsibility. So every culture I've worked in, these items are reinforced as being a good, responsible person if you do these things. If you beat yourself up for making a mistake, right? Oh, good boy, you're taking responsibility. And in obligation, if you're doing what you're supposed to do, even if you despise it, hate it, have physical symptoms of stress and other things, right? You're being a responsible citizen. So in terms of trying to help people build practices, what I'm trying to do is to figure out how to set up communities where there are people who will help remind each other. You know, that the cultural trance is so strong and we need another place to come to where we can help each other change those habits of mind and replace that. One of my students, who's 24, says that trying to practice responsibility by yourself is like trying to quit smoking with five housemates who smoke.
Because we're immersed in cultures that do the opposite of responsibility.
Yes.
That do all the below-the-line behaviors.
Right. Yeah. And those cultures, they call responsibility being good.
Mm.
Being a good citizen. Keeping out of trouble. Getting a good education. Getting good jobs. Be part of a family unit. Be part of a community. Mm. Contribute to society. That's called being responsible. And I have no qualm with that. But it's different than taking 100% responsibility. It's different than having a commitment to grow, to overcome any issue or challenge or upset that you have.
Mm. So I think there's a really interesting distinction there between maybe being responsible and taking responsibility. And I hear maybe the latter in what you're saying. Taking responsibility in the way you're defining it is being at choice in the moment, looking to the future, tapped into your resources. Mm-hmm. It's not giving yourself a hard time for what's gone wrong in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a shift in focus.
Yes.
Got it.
Very much so.
Before you mentioned this idea of working with partners when you're trying to learn and practice responsibility, what in Scrum, they have the idea of ceremonies like daily stand-ups and retros and so on. Are there ways that organizations have like scheduled in time to look at responsibility apart from just it happening fluidly and organically?
There are. two primary ones I can think of is that most of my clients who are Scrum coaches or Scrum masters have brought the practice of wins into their meetings. So a win, we define a win as an intention met. Let me see if I can give you the shorthand version of this. The three keys to unlocking and accessing the responsibility process are intention, which is a capability we're born with and can develop, awareness, also a capability we're born with and can develop, and confront, or the ability to face. So not being confrontational or abusive or aggressive, but simply the ability to feel our own angst and instead of running away from it, actually be willing to feel it and face it and look in the mirror and see what there is for us to learn. So intention, we practice intention by claiming wins, and a win is an intention met, something you intended to have happen or experience and it did, or something you intended to not have happen or experience and it didn't. And the more you realize that your intentions are being met all day long, every day, the more you stop complaining, ranting, seeing things happen to you like the bus schedule being late or rain coming down or whatever as, ugh, right? And you realize part of the cultural trance is that we all go around complaining about our situation, about our environment, about what's happening to us, even just in small ways, right? We ask each other, how's the world treating you? And I say, wrong question, how are you treating your world? Right? And so a wins practice would simply take 5 minutes at the beginning of the meeting and saying, what wins do we have from the last time we met? And the part of the game is there's no size. And so most of us think that we're supposed to find something huge that we knocked out of the park. And a win is simply an intention met. You know, I intended to get up this morning and have a reasonable breakfast before I got to work, and I did, and I don't always do that, and that's a win. And it's amazing how much positivity it brings to a group when you practice that. So that's one. Another is that I see the responsibility process being used in retros a great deal. And in fact, if you, just search online, there's a number of blog posts from coaches who talk about how they're using the responsibility process in a retrospective.
And I guess, is there a connection as well between responsibility and maybe just in a sense of appreciation and gratitude? In positive psychology has done a lot of research into gratitude recently, and I brought that into some of the coaching that I do, and that seems to really reinvigorate relationships and humanity and focus on getting good outcomes.
Huge. So I mentioned WINS. In all of our meetings within the Leadership Gift Program, we call it WINS and Acknowledgements. And I started consulting to the Whole Foods Organization in the United States 25 years ago. And they've always had a meeting ceremony at the end of meetings called Appreciations, which people can't wait to get to. And it just leaves everybody leaving the meeting feeling really great. So I totally align with you there. The other thing is, the more I practice responsibility, the more I realize how connected I am to everybody and everything in the world, and how there's no way I could be doing what I'm doing by myself. So I have extensive gratitude. So responsibility is all about the perception of cause and effect. And the more I practice responsibility, the more I realize that I am, it's one thing to think I'm being a victim. It's another thing to think that I am being upheld, I'm being helped, I'm being supported, right? By lots and lots of forces around me that I may not see otherwise.
In an email that I sent you as I was reading the book, I was struggling with a particular problem. I don't know how much I want to reveal my inner problems here on the podcast, but I guess it might be beneficial to the listeners just to sort of live through an example of this and see what it sort of looks like.
Yeah, and I'd invite you to figure out how to characterize it without all the juicy details.
Yeah. So the context, I guess, being in the situation that I'm in, where I've been obviously working with a lot of different people, trying to progress a large work item, and I'm not necessarily the owner of that of that work item. I'm not the accountable person for that work item, and yet every now and then I'm pulled in to help out with it. And the thing that I've struggled with is where that work item that I'm not accountable for keeps going down a path that I have perceived to be really scarily bad. And the struggle that I had with the responsibility process was where the line was as far as my actions were versus when someone else is not being responsible. How do I deal with that? So I certainly felt like in that particular scenario that I pushed myself time and time again to not react emotionally to the situation, to act quite professionally and to deal with those concerns. And yet at a certain point in time, it's almost like talking in the wind. And I wasn't quite sure at the time that I sent the email how to best deal with that.
Have you resolved it since then?
I feel like I have, but I'm not entirely sure if I'm actually deluding myself, to be honest. So I finished off your book. I pretty much have worked through Byron Katie's book at the same time, and through her work, I think I found a lot of inner peace in that. And I was telling Peter earlier that it sort of ended up feeling like a relationship that you would have with a boyfriend. You have this relationship, you really want to make it work. And then I had that realization that he just wasn't into me in that relationship. And I was giving an awful lot more of myself than was happening on the other side. And in that moment, it was a huge relief. It's sort of like, well, he's just not into me. And that's okay. I should just find somewhere where another relationship where they're into me.
And so what happened to the work item? Well, first of all, congratulations on finding some relief.
I think the thing is, I'm actually not accountable for it. I've tried my hardest, but they are. And it's their choice whether to step up or not. And it's my choice whether I choose to have anxiety over it or not.
Right.
And so I chose to no longer have anxiety over it.
Congratulations. So, do you feel complete?
Well, Peter, who knows me very well, said to me at lunchtime today, gee, you're looking really happy, Renee.
Yeah, I did. So
you
that's
are.
Why.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you feel complete.
Yeah, I definitely feel very complete. And not only just that, but also through your book as well, in that there was a section in there that talked about setting goals and sort of prioritizing those goals and living in joy in those goals and sort of melding your work between Byron Katie's work. It really made me appreciate that a lot of the angst that I was going through was actually really low on my list of things that were important to me. And so I had a lot more joy in everything else that was around me.
So, can you find the unconscious attention that you, intention that you were trying to serve? Was it around trying to make this relationship work?
I think it wasn't just, and I think there was very much a selfish element in that as well. And it was, yes, making the relationship work was part of it. But I think there was a very selfish element of wanting to be heard. And as soon as I lost that need to be heard, I lost that anxiety.
Can you identify where on the chart you think you were during that time?
Oh, yes. I was very much between justify and lay blame constantly.
Ah, okay.
It's quite far down. I kept thinking, I'm being responsible, I'm trying to make this work, and so that's...
But he's
that's
the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. I heard more there.
Oh, no!
Here we go.
Go on.
Well, did I hear you had feelings of, you know, have to try and make this work?
That's my job.
Okay. So where's that in this chart?
I don't think that's obligation. I actually responsibly own that. He's, for everyone who's listening, he's looking at me as if in dubious disbelief of me right now.
I'm not. Boy, no way do I want to invalidate you.
But.
I heard. So, in my experience, the professionals of the world, we hang out in shame, obligation, and quit, which we haven't talked about quit here.
Mm. Yeah, I did wonder about the quit, to be honest.
It's when you realized that if you're working harder than he is, right, then that's no good. You get to keep that problem. Right? Before that, I heard elements of obligation and quit. But the point I want to make here is that once we start practicing this, we get off of blame and justify pretty quickly.
Mm.
But we have been so reinforced to be good people. So we get totally screwed up in shame and obligation and quit thinking that we are being responsible. And people come to me and they want me to assess, you know, their situation. They give me this long story and say, so I did this. Is that being responsible? And my answer is, I don't know. How do you feel? Because it's a feeling state of release, of joy, of freedom, of power. Yeah.
So what are you encouraging me to think of now?
I was just exploring to see if you felt any obligation there, right? So the work item, you felt like it was your job to do something about, even though it wasn't your accountability. But now it's like, screw it.
No, it's definitely not screw it.
Oh, okay.
No. No, it's if I get asked, I'll joyously help.
Okay.
But I no longer feel the pain of not necessarily helping.
Got it. My guess is he didn't enjoy your help.
Yeah, I know that.
All right. So,
of which I have.
So we have a
I have an element
there.
of accountability or responsibility for that relationship.
Of course you do. You yeah. created the whole thing.
Yep,
he
I did.
Created the whole thing too, but
I
you
did,
created
yep.
the whole thing.
Yep.
So we have a kind of a principle around that, which is unwanted help is abuse.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. That is a conclusion that I did get to. Yes.
Which goes to the coaching principle of always seek permission.
Mm.
Yeah.
To coach.
Yeah.
Christopher, what's the difference? How do you distinguish between quit and choosing not to do?
For me, the difference is feeling complete.
Mm.
So quit is a mental state, and for podcast listeners, it's a little off to the right on the chart of shame and obligation, and I... often when I'm time constrained, I don't speak about it at all. But it's kind of like the steam let-off valve on a water heater, that if the water heater overheats, right, it needs a way to not explode. And in blame and justify, we do a lot of venting. And that venting actually modulates the feeling of anxiety. The anxiety never goes away because we're never dealing with the real problem. But we can modulate the anxiety by venting. So we know from psychology that anxiety, that if we get into action, any kind of action, that we modulate the anxiety. So, you know, people say, when I'm feeling stressed, I go for an 8-mile run. Sure you do, right? And we use shame to shame our charges, our kids, our students, or somebody to get them into action.
Mm.
Right? But the question is, you know, what kind of results are they going to produce in that mental state?
Mm.
So in shame and obligation, the angst is more internalized. And if you don't know what to do to release it, which means to get to the mental state of responsibility and get the learning, get the growth, then there's this great need to get rid of it somehow. So quit is a mental parking place where we think that we can drive it over here and park it and close the garage door and pretend it's not there. So the examples that I give are, you know, if you have an important dream that you've given up on because it's not practical, right? But every now and then it wakes up and says, hi, remember me? I'm in this garage here.
Mm.
You parked me here. I didn't go anywhere.
Mm.
You go, shit. or the, you know, the common day saying, whatever. So choosing to not deal with it.
It normally has an edge to it, whatever, doesn't it? It
yeah.
isn't truly just, I'm 100% okay with reality being that way.
Right.
It's more like, I don't like reality being that way, but I'll joke around about it.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's mentally disengaging. It's probably what we would call disengagement.
Yeah. Got it.
And people who ask, people get it confused with physically leaving a situation. And if they ask me to help them out about that, the most direct question is, do you feel complete with this place you're leaving? Have you done what you came to do? Or have you realized there's no way you can do what you came to do? Right? You're not going to have any regrets. You're not going to be going to bed every night thinking, only if, or you know, if only X. So...
Changing tack a little bit, you mentioned earlier that obviously the responsibility process is self-applied, and one of the bad ways to use it is to use it as a weapon against others. Are there some other kind of blind alleys that people sometimes go down with the responsibility process where it just doesn't work, or it doesn't come to life somehow?
There are blind alleys, and one which is associated with the idea that it only works when self-applied is that, you know, to pick a number, it's 1,000 or 10,000 times easier to see it in other people than to see it in yourself. Right? And so, and, you know, that has all to do with how we perceive ourselves versus how we perceive others. But the impetus there, especially in smart people and busy people, is that they've heard the keynote, they've sat through the video, whatever, they don't need any more of it. But boy, they sure see everybody else who needs it. And that's really where I've turned my attention. So the other thing is that while it's very titillating, and I've spent much of my career figuring out how to really inspire people in a talk to think about it, is the truth is very few people who learn about it actually adopt a practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've really turned my attention towards, you know, how do I get people to move up that curve from interest past caution, because it does, you know, you burn your finger on the stove sometimes when you start trying to apply it because of the confront aspect or the ego challenge. And how do I get people through that to the other side to, you know, true commitment to practicing?
And you've got a program to help with that, don't you?
I have a program that's designed just for that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So it's called the Leadership Gift Program. And you can imagine why it's called the Leadership Gift. It's because we all have this in us, but most of us never realize it. And for me, it is the mental pattern to self-leadership. And the Leadership Program is available to people worldwide who actually want our help being immersed in a community of people who are supporting each other in developing a practice. And it's taken what I learned to do in corporations doing deep leadership development work that would be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and strip out all of that cost and put it in an online e-learning community that anybody can join. And a lot of people like to join when we are launching a new semester. I don't know what your date is for this podcast.
I will take responsibility to get it out quickly.
Okay. So we have a new semester starting October 6th. It's a 16-week semester where I will be teaching the 8 core modules live every other week. Not good time for Aussies, so I would say it really doesn't matter. You can join anytime because all that stuff is pre-recorded. But I have offered that when 25 Aussies join the program, and we've got a bunch of people joining this week and last week, then I'll schedule a call that's very convenient for your time zone.
Awesome. So in addition to the program, you have a book where people can read about the responsibility process called The Responsibility Process.
How about that? We had a difficult time naming it.
If people have any questions or want to contact you, how do they best do that?
Yeah, so first of all, the Leadership Gift Program is at the.leadershipgift.com. So it's subdomain, the.leadershipgift.com. You can contact me through there, through the hello email address at the bottom, or my main website, christopheravery.com.
Thank you. And you can contact myself as well, Renee@theagilerevolution.com. And Peter, do you want anyone to contact you?
I don't really have any social media contact details, so I'm a bit social media shy, I must say.
So if you want to get in contact with Peter, get in contact with me, and then I'll just pass on the message, I guess.
Sounds good to me.
Thank you once again for coming along.
Oh, thanks so much, Renee.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Peter.
And,
it was great to know you.
And as Peter is a long-time listener, he knows how we end the call, and if you remember correctly... Oh, he doesn't?
I don't.
All right. We end the call with Viva la Revolution.
Viva la Revolution.
Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Viva la Revolution.